the Riviera of the Middle East, though many are refusing to leave even as the delivery of mobile homes has not yet occurred through Israeli checkpoints. Pacifica's Romy Almigara reports from the Gaza Strip.
Ali Alada says he is determined to live in Gaza, his homeland, even if reconstruction of the territory will take decades.
This is never a life. They should make sure to get us the needed resources and supplies.
The Palestinians' post-war struggle is exacerbated by the delayed entry of reconstruction supplies and relief materials into Gaza. These include some 60,000 promised mobile homes as part of a ceasefire deal. Akram Atallah, a Gaza political analyst, suggests preventing mobile homes from entering the Gaza Strip is another form of a pressure to get Palestinians to leave so Israel can control Gaza.
May want to transfer Palestinians out. This makes it difficult to answer the question, who will be in control of Gaza after the war?
For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Almighari.
I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
In Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, February 21st, 2025. And we're also in the middle of WPFW's Winter Pledge Drive right now, which gives you the opportunity to support the Latino Media Collective by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. You can also call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Our goal at this hour is $500, and it's only possible with your support for independent media outlets like WPFW. So once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Puerto Rico to discuss how Immigration Customs and Enforcement, also known as ICE, has established a presence on the island and what it means to migrants who make their way there. And with us on the show today is Carlos Berrios Polanco. He's a freelance writer based in Puerto Rico. His recent article in late January that came out on a Latino newsletter is entitled Puerto Rico's Dominican community terrified after immigration raids. Fear and uncertainty grow as reports emerge of detentions, racial profiling, and legal confusion. He joins us on the show from Puerto Rico. Welcome to the show, Carlos Berrios Polanco.
Hey, Oscar. Thanks for having me. Good to connect again after so many years.
Absolutely. It's great to hear from you again. So I'll tell you the same thing before we started recording the show. In all my years of covering how the U.S. criminalizes migrants and the use of ICE to detain and deport migrants, it never occurred to me that ICE could establish a presence in Puerto Rico. Oftentimes, the corporate media narrative puts the issue of homeland security or national security, however you want to call it, with regards to institutions like ICE, CBP, and Homeland Security along the U.S.-Mexico border. But it never occurred to me that they could possibly do the same thing in Puerto Rico. So this is something that really caught my attention in your article that I think requires a point of clarification. Is this something new and unprecedented in Puerto Rico, the presence of ICE there, or has there been other ways of enforcing immigration laws in the U.S. and Puerto Rico that people may have not have noticed because so much attention is on the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yeah, so one thing that I've always said is that Puerto Rico is the other border. So you have the U.S.-Mexico border, that is like where the main attention is since time immemorial. You have the U.S.-Canada border, and those are the most present for citizens living in the continental United States. But then Puerto Rico is the other border because it's in an archipelago. Once you go outside of land, that's all an international border, more or less, right? And we're also right by the Mona Passage, which is an important navigation route between the Atlantic and the Panama Canal. So you'll have the most kind of visible immigration enforcement comes in the form of Coast Guard stopping boats coming from the Dominican Republic full of migrants who make the very dangerous decision and the very dangerous travel from the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico to land on the southern part of the island. Is mostly the type of immigration enforcement you'll see is mostly that. But there's been ICE here and CBP here as long as those organizations have existed, except that their, you know, enforcement of immigration law has been significantly more quiet. And I think as we've seen throughout the United States, that type of hard kind of mean to if, is how I see it. Immigration enforcement has become way more prominent under the Trump administration. And you, at least in terms of Puerto Rico, the raid that happened in January, at the tail end of January, in a community that has a big Dominican population, was the first of its kind that many people have seen here, right? This type of militarized police raid that I always say is made for TV, made for cameras to capture and then disseminate in order to kind of produce an awe factor and a is kind of how I've always seen it. But that was the first of its kind, at least that I've seen in my years as a journalist, right? And since then, there was some pretty public backlash from members of the Dominican community, the immigrant community, and regular Puerto Ricans that has meant that they've kind of done this immigration enforcement pushed by the Trump executive order, but they've done it way more quietly compared to that first like militarized raid.
Yeah, we should talk about the immigrant community in Puerto Rico because, again, this issue of the other border, as you described it, has gone under the radar for several years. And even as we had this conversation right now, the only article I've been able to find with regards to this has been in Telemundo. They've only done one YouTube video. There's only been one YouTube video found that I could find with regards to what took place in late January that you describe in your article, which goes to show you how under the radar this story is, but no less alarming when it comes to the detention of immigrants. And we can imagine the fear that they have right now because of the other issue of Guantanamo Bay being reported to be used for detaining migrants, even if they don't have a criminal record. So let's talk about the immigrant community in Puerto Rico, because you mentioned that there is a sizable Dominican community there. How would you measure the size of this community in Puerto Rico And if there are other migrant groups that have made their way to the island that also deserve our attention.
So just to speak a little bit about the Dominican community, my mom is from the Dominican Republic, and so are my grandparents, and they came over here in the 70s before moving back to the DR and then coming back again in the 80s. So Puerto Rico has a fairly sizable Dominican population. The Dominican population is the largest non-Puerto Rican group on the archipelago, I believe, and the second largest, I believe, is Cubans. So they make up a sizable portion of the population. Not even, I don't believe it's even close to half. I believe it's somewhere closer to like 10% more or less. And by that I mean people who just came from the Dominican Republic and people who have Dominican ancestry like myself, I believe make up a sizable portion of the Puerto Rican population. And then there are also, like I said, mentioned Cuban communities and Chinese communities and other migrant communities. So to talk a little bit about this executive order when it was first announced, obviously the immigrant communities of Puerto Rico were a little worried, as I'm sure immigrant communities were all over the United States. But the Puerto Rican governor who was just sworn in January of this year, kind of assured these communities that Trump was focused on the U.S.-Mexico border. But as we saw with that raid, that was totally false. You know, they're focusing on migrants all over the United States, whether it's at the U.S.-Mexico border or if it's like in Milwaukee or Puerto Rico or anywhere, right? So a lot of the community, from what they have told me, have felt like betrayed by that statement. You know, they thought they were safe, so they were going about their daily lives, and then That's when they went through this immigration raid where several people were picked up, both undocumented and documented. There were, coming from that raid in January, there were two men who were documented who were detained. One was a Dominican man who showed them showed ICE their license. And they didn't take that as proof of citizenship, so they detained him, and then he was able to prove his citizenship. And then another was a Haitian man who was detained by federal authorities for about 2 days before he was able to prove his legal citizenship in the United States. And it's kind of been and you know, that really scared the community a lot. I was in Barrio Obrero, which is a community that has had a historically a very large Dominican population, and a lot of the community is scared that they're going to get picked up by federal authorities, even if they have legal U.S. residency documents or citizenship documents, because as one migrant, one person in the Dominican community told me, they feel like these federal authorities are racially profiling them because they're either black or darker skinned and also have like a pronounced Dominican accent, right? So one thing that they told me they believed happened was that the federal authorities asked them for identification, and when they heard the accent, that's when they were like, oh, this person is Dominican. And you know, Barrio Obrero, which is the community that was one of the communities that was targeted in this January immigration raid, heavily Dominican, right? And there is a mix of documented and undocumented people in that neighborhood, but they're all, you know, it's majority like darker skinned people. So a lot of the people felt that they were being targeted because they were darker skinned.
Yeah, you know what? That was something that before we started recording this conversation, I found rather perverse, is that we're not in Texas or Arizona or New Mexico per se. With regards to this conversation, we're in Puerto Rico, where the majority of everyone on the island speaks Spanish. So how would you differentiate, you know, a Puerto Rican from a Dominican other than the racial profiling that you mentioned? And it's sort of perverse in that way, this whole thing developing of ICE in Puerto Rico. And by the way, I should mention that as we had this conversation, the same thing is also happening in the U.S. Virgin Islands as well, which is another...
It's the other border.
The other border. So, I mean, it's perverse. I mean, The U.S. Virgin Islands has a population of at least 100,000 people. And so the idea of spending this money to criminalize migrants, even in a small island like the U.S. Virgin Islands, let alone Puerto Rico, is so absurd, but speaks volumes to the xenophobic nature of this current administration. I want to know if you could elaborate a little bit more about some of the people that you spoke with for this article. Were you able to speak with Dominican migrants? Again, I saw the video that Telemundo did with regards to this story. And as you can imagine, people want to hide their identities so they won't, you know, for fear of being detained and deported and everything in between. Were you able to talk to people and were they able to express the same fear that you've described?
For the article, I exclusively talked to Dominican migrants who had documented citizenship in the United States, because as an indie outlet, as a reporter that's not as famous as Telemundo, it's harder to get that sort of access and for people to trust you, right? But the ones that I spoke to, you know, they were scared. You know, they full-heartedly believe that they at some point they will be detained or stopped and made to show their citizenship documents in order to not be detained by these federal authorities. For example, I spoke to one man in Barrio Obrero who carries his green card on him at all times and his license. And when I was speaking to him, he pulled out like a variety of documents for his fanny pack that he was ready to show anybody who asked him. I think I mentioned that in the article, if I remember correctly. Then I spoke to two or three other migrants who are doing essentially the same thing, right? They keep their documents on them. If detained, they're like absolutely ready at a moment's notice to show them, because they are, you know, they're genuinely afraid that they will be detained, even if they are documented, just because of the color of their skin or their accent. Right. And then there was a very good article by the Puerto Rico Center of Investigative Journalism who spoke to a undocumented mother and her son about like the fear that they live in after this executive order went into effect.
Man, yeah, that's quite disturbing, to say the least. Another thing that you mentioned in the article was that some of the people that you spoke to had that feeling of surprise, in much the same way that I did, of the idea of ISIS presence on the island. You mentioned earlier that this was something that was made for TV, as far as camera crews following immigration authorities to arrest migrants. I saw a little bit on YouTube. And one thing I need to point out that, you know, speaks probably to the larger issue of Puerto Rican sovereignty and things that have been discussed in the past with regards to either statehood or independence. I saw ICE authorities with the words police on their uniforms in English, the acronyms for ICE and Homeland Security in English, in a predominantly Spanish-speaking island. And it doesn't escape me the juxtaposition of those things, not only when it comes to immigration enforcement, but also to the issue, the long-standing issue of Puerto Rican sovereignty. And so I would imagine that it would stick in the crawl of Puerto Ricans to see that, even no matter how small of an operation it was last month, it still, or you could correct me if I'm wrong, does it get under the issue of some of these things that you covered in the past as an independent reporter?
So it's kind of hard to perform a vibe check in these circumstances, right? But historically, Puerto Rico has been more welcoming to migrants, I would say, compared to the continental United States. For example, when my grandparents came to the Puerto Rico, they were on a program from the government of Puerto Rico to bring doctors to the archipelago, is what they've told me. And there has always been a kind of vibrant migrant community, right? And there has always been, especially in like the independence supporters, there has always been that connection with other like islands in the Caribbean, or other nations in the Caribbean. So from that angle, there is very much a pro-immigration stance, although not entirely, right? There is some I have seen some like arguably like pro-independence leftists kind of exude some very nationalist things since these immigration raids. But at the same time, on the statehood side of the debate, there are people who are pro-migrant as well, even though we're currently under a Republican administration at both the federal and the state level, right? I feel like I would bet that on average, Puerto Ricans are more supportive of immigration than like the average U.S. citizen, for example, right? But it's hard to tell. There's so much like history wrapped up in everything, and you know, the conflict with the U.S. has always been very present for a lot of the conflict or the relationship with the United States, I should say, has been very present for many Puerto Ricans and for a lot of like the pro-independence crowd or the pro-sovereignty crowd. This is just kind of shown who really is in charge in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's a
right
much bigger nuanced conversation that deserves a one-hour conversation in and of itself. And this is precisely why we do programs like these, to have fantastic guests like Carlos Berrios Polanco from Puerto Rico to have this conversation that really has gone under the radar but deserves our attention, especially for the listeners here in Washington, the WPFW audience, because when it comes to the undermining of the local government and the local democratic process in Puerto Rico, it's no different from what we've seen here in Washington. I mean, it could be argued, and it has been argued several times by various other hosts on WPFW, that Washington, our hometown here, is sort of in the same category of colonies as Puerto Rico, as the U.S. Virgin Islands, as Guam, as the Northern Marianas Islands. Those are five colonies of the U.S. right there. And so as we had this conversation, we could easily replace Puerto Rico and put Washington in this conversation right now with regards to the fear and trepidation that immigrants have in this community, much in the same way as in Puerto Rico right now. We could put in Washington in the same way as we discuss how government officials have been undermined by this current Trump administration in Puerto Rico, as in Washington right now, as we have this conversation. And most importantly, and this is something that Carlos just brought up right now, that Puerto Ricans are just as welcoming of migrants as residents here in Washington as well. But it's only possible to keep stories like these fantastic stories and fantastic guests like Carlos Berrios Polanco on the show, if you support the Latino Media Collective at this hour. So again, we are in the middle of WPFW's Winter Place Drive, so we encourage everyone to go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so, so we can continue to have fantastic guests like Carlos Berrios Polanco on the show, even as we had this conversation right now. As I mentioned last week on the show, the Trump administration is going after public media outlets like NPR, PBS, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And so the window for independent voices like our guest today is continuing to get smaller and smaller. In addition to that, on a local level, the Trump administration has also made a hostile takeover of the Kennedy Center. They have also made plans to change or make DC great again, in his words, not ours, certainly not ours. We mentioned last week on the show the ridiculous story of reclaiming the Panama Canal, which is another show that we intend to do in the coming weeks and months ahead. And there is no ambiguity here. There is no beating around the bush. There are no dog whistles as to what we're seeing right now when it comes to colonialism, imperialism from this current administration. And let's make it very clear, it does not happen in a vacuum, and it does not happen overnight. And the only way we could magnify this reality, a reality that corporate media seems to miss, the only way to do that is to support local independent media outlets like WPFW. So once again, make a donation to WPFWFN.org for the Latino Media Collective. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So allow me to go back to to our guest today and our conversation about ISIS presence in Puerto Rico. So, Carlos, in your article, when asked about detaining and arresting people with some sort of regularized migration status, Homeland Security Investigations Director Rebecca Gonzalez-Ramos stated to local media that, quote, there will be collateral damage with regards to people with no criminal records. And this is something that you mentioned in your article. Could you expand on this quote from Gonzalez-Ramos when compared to what immigrant rights attorneys would otherwise argue as false arrest or false imprisonment? Because what is collateral damage in the context of this conversation other than wrongfully arresting people who have no criminal records whatsoever?
I think there will be collateral damage has been the policy of the national security establishment since 9/11, right? And that has spilled over into every federal agency, whether it's like the people currently imprisoned in Guantanamo without charges, both migrants who were taken there recently and people who've been there for decades, down to this sort of immigration raid that's taking place, or immigration enforcement that's taking place in Puerto Rico. So in the context that she said that, she was asked about people who have regularized migration status that get picked up by these federal authorities. And I should clarify that while ICE does have a presence in Puerto Rico, there is a much bigger contingent of like other federal authorities. So if you see pictures of that January raid, there was ICE and other federal authorities such as CBP, and there's another one that I can't remember right now, my apologies. But this kind of like combined federal authorities, she was speaking for them from what I saw, talking about how they pick up citizens with regular or people with regularized migration status, as you know, is very dismissive. You know, they're just saying, oh, it happens, but you know, these are people's lives on the line, and they're like peace as well, right? You know, these people went for a very hard ordeal to obtain that regularized migration status, and it's, you know, kind of being thrown in their face that they went through this ordeal, and they're just considered part of the collateral damage of kind of enforcing these racist, xenophobic migration laws. I don't know, there's this something like cruelty in the mundanity of that statement, right? Just like offhand dismissal that often comes with the way that these like bureaucratic policies are played out in real life. You know, it's just a paper signed somewhere in the White House or whatever. But, you know, when it comes down to places like Puerto Rico or the U.S.-Mexico border, it ends up being a lot of pain and punishment inflicted on people who are just looking for better lives for them and their families.
It's really a slap in the face to the island as well, to Puerto Rico as a whole, especially when it's coming from this current administration, because I don't know if you remember the infamous rally that Trump had in Madison Square Garden in New York, where he degraded Puerto Rico in particular, you know, just before the election. And so it's just another chapter of another slap in the face, I should say, to Puerto Rico and undermining Puerto Rican democracy or the democratic process in Puerto Rico as well. And this is precisely why we have fantastic guests like Carlos Berrios Polanco on the show. He's a freelance writer based in Puerto Rico. His recent article in the Latino newsletter is entitled Puerto Rico's Dominican Community Terrified After Immigration Raid. We're going to take a break right here. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Soy el dolor. Soy la memoria.
That was Ile, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez. And we're speaking about ICE's presence in Puerto Rico with freelance writer Carlos Berrios Polanco, whose recent article in the Latino newsletter is entitled Puerto Rico's Dominican Community Terrified After Immigration Raids. And once again, we are in the middle of WPFW's Winter Pledge Drive, so we encourage everyone to support independent media outlets like WPFW and the Latino Media Collective. At this hour, make a donation to WPFWFM.org, and if you have the Cash App on your phone, go to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. So going back to your article, Carlos, I want to ask you two things, but we'll deal with the first component of this first, and that is the reaction of immigrant rights attorneys on the island. The other component I want to ask you about is the reaction of government officials, because the impression I got in your article was that local government officials in Puerto Rico were taken by surprise of this. But putting that aside right now, what has been the reaction of immigrant rights groups or attorneys with regards to what took place? Because much like everyone else, I'm assuming they were taken by surprise by the manner in which ICE has made its presence in Puerto Rico. And it seems to me like this is a sign of a lot more things to come. Because like we said before we started recording, it's going to be a long 4 years in Puerto Rico under the Trump administration.
Yeah, definitely emblematic of a long 4 years to come. But thankfully, immigration rights groups and immigration attorneys and civil society organizations, human rights organizations have all very, very quickly they stepped up to the plate to defend the rights of the migrant community as a whole and the rights of the specific migrants who were detained by ICE during that raid. And they have continued to do that work after the raid, continuing to educate not only migrant communities, but Puerto Ricans in general about the rights of migrants and the rights that they have if they're stopped by federal authorities. But, you know, there are serious obstacles placed in front of them, specifically the immigration rights lawyers, to be able to do this work. For example, I interviewed an immigration rights lawyer who it took her 2 days to even get in contact with the migrant that she was defending because of how nebulous, how much of a black box the immigration system is in Puerto Rico. There's not a lot of information about where migrants are taken to, where they're detained, you know, and there's not really a lot of available, what's the word, like holding facilities in Puerto Rico. So, you know, sometimes they get transferred to Miami they're transferred to Miami very quickly. So you then have to coordinate with an immigration rights group over there for them to be able to plead their case in front of a judge. And for example, I want to specifically highlight the psychological effects that being detained has on a person, right?
Yes.
You go from being having a normal day to being shoved in a box with however many other people, like 20 or 30 or so. That has a real psychological effect on you. You know, you might not know that you're entitled to an attorney. You might not know that you're entitled to like the rights provided by the U.S. immigration law. And as we've seen over the last however many years, I believe since Obama was in office, the process of expedited removals sometimes skips the ability for migrants to actually plead their case in front of a judge. And specifically talking about the psychological impact, there were 11 migrants detained in that raid who signed the voluntary papers to be deported back to their home countries before they, from my understanding, before they were even able to talk to an immigration attorney, right? And it's unclear if those people were actually deported to their home countries, if those people were ever able to talk to an attorney, because of how much of a black box the situation is, right? You hear about it in the news, And then you don't really hear from those people again, right? You don't know enough about them. And especially if they're transferred out of Puerto Rico to Miami, then you have to be able to find them there. You know, so you can coordinate cases here, but at the rate that these federal authorities seem to be trying to, like, detain migrants, it seems like a very arduous task for civil rights groups and migrants' attorneys, right?
Thank you for mentioning the psychological effects of what's going on right now, because that by itself is a one-hour conversation that deserves our attention. The idea of going about your business and then all of a sudden you see militarized, armed government officials detaining you and asking you all sorts of questions, and questions that could, you know, you mentioned, you know, voluntary deportation. It's almost a form, not almost, it really is a form of extortion.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And we've seen a lot of extortion in the past month alone with this new administration, because in various parts of the country right now, whether it be in New York or in other states, there's been the threat of cutting federal funding if certain states don't follow the new anti-immigration agenda of this current administration. And so that leads me to the other question that I want to ask you about, which is the government response, because are they sort of facing sort of the same issue of extortion or the loss of federal funding if they don't allow ICE and these other anti-immigrant groups to conduct what they're planning to do, which is detention and deportation of migrants? Are they facing the same situation as states here in the U.S.? And can they do anything about it? Because before we started this conversation, you mentioned to me that there is concerns in Puerto Rico about cutting funding from the National Weather Service, which is certainly not good for Puerto Rico considering the number of hurricanes that have hit the island last several years alone. And so tying that all together, what has been the response of the local government in Puerto Rico, and can they do anything to combat it?
So to backtrack a bit, I mentioned that the new governor had said that Trump was going to focus on the U.S.-Mexico border, which ended up being a complete lie, and she was very surprised by it. And I would argue that governors should not be surprised by this kind of thing when it's written out in executive orders, but alas. She said she was very surprised by it, but then a couple of days later, I believe, she said that there was nothing that she could do about it because of a provision in that executive order specifically talking about targeting federal funding for states and territories that do not immediately comply with these executive orders targeting migration policy, right? And I can't remember the name of the order, but it was like something Make America and then the immigration order. But that was her argument, that Puerto Rico had to comply with all of these like new federal policies concerning immigration, or else federal funding to Puerto Rico would be cut off. And if you know anything about Puerto Rico over the last decade or so, Puerto Rico is in a pretty bad financial crisis, and it has been for a very long time. And the way that our kind of economy has been structured over a very long period of time is that we rely extensively on federal funding. So any threat to that federal funding is kind of an existential threat to Puerto Rico's economy, which was part of her argument to comply with these executive orders immediately. Although, and then she very obviously drew criticism from the people who don't believe that our economy should be structured that way, or who kind of predicted such a crisis would come about in the age of Trump, who has always said that he wants to cut federal funding to a bunch of places, not just Puerto Rico. Right. So essentially that's where we're at, right? That she automatically complied. Some people argued, and I would have argued as well, that she should have fought back against that. But, you know, it's a Republican president and a Republican governor, so that wasn't going to happen. But the resident commissioner who is Puerto Rico's non-voting representative in Congress, who's a Democrat, he's doing a little bit more. You know, I spoke with him for the article at an event that he did in Barrio Obrero, and he told me to kind of the Puerto Rico should be prepared for the worst, regardless of the legality of it, right? But it is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, many people that I've talked to would have preferred that Puerto Rico put some kind of a fight in, put up a fight instead of complying immediately. You know, at least I would say it wasn't as eagerly as some of the red states, but it could have put up more of a fight, like some of the Democratic cities and states throughout the United States. But sadly, it did not. And there have been some very, like, suspect things going on, right? There was, I believe shortly after that article came out, it came out that the Department of Justice in Puerto Rico was forming, like, kind of lists of people that they attend who are immigrants. And then they tried to, like, say that it was only because they wanted to continue servicing those people. But, you know, obviously there are a lot of people worried about what happens to those lists once they're created, if they're created. And there was a similar situation with the Department of Education, where there was a district where the teachers union was saying that people were calling around trying to get information about students who were migrants, right? And there's a lot of worry about what ends up happening what ends up happening to those lists once they're created, if they're created. Because in theory, the federal government could just say, hey, we know this list exists. I want you to give it to me, right? So there's a big worry about that, but not a lot of information has come out of that since. And this is kind of where we're at a little bit. You know, we're in a little bit of a holding pattern, right? The immigrant communities and the migrant communities and their allies are very tense, very scared, you know, about what's going to happen in the future, and kind of come to the realization that they have to rely on each other, because the government isn't going to help them as much as they would have fought, or as much as they would like, right?
You know, the focus of this conversation is on Puerto Rico, but if we expand the conversation here with regards to institutions like ICE and CBP and Homeland Security, what we're also talking about here is the exportation of institutional racism through the lens of immigration, or in their words, national security. And I bring this up to you now because, yes, it is institutional racism. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there was a story of ICE detaining a Puerto Rican family because they were speaking Spanish. What other way can we describe a case like that other than institutional racism? One, the idea of detaining a Puerto Rican family because they are U.S. citizens, and also because they were speaking Spanish. Imagine that. Again, this is institutional racism being exported to places like Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. I don't remember if it was Arizona or New Mexico, but there was also the story of indigenous Navajos being detained by ICE as well. And there's no other way that could happen other than racial profiling and institutional racism, which is now being exported to the colonies like Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Can that happen here in Washington, D.C.? It has already, and it's been happening for quite some time. It was here on WPFW that broke the story several years ago that one of the former mayors here of Washington had a secret handshake deal to, you know, do the show me your papers type of law, the SB 1070 type laws here in Arizona, behind closed doors with secret handshakes and with little to no input by the general public. But that story came out, and it was only possible through independent media outlets like WPFW. Which is, again, why we encourage everyone to support the Latino Media Collective at this time, at this hour, by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation at this hour. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make the donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. Because chances are, this conversation that we're having with Carlos today is just the tip of the iceberg, possibly, of more things to the detriment of immigrant rights in places like Puerto Rico. So, Carlos, Are there any other components of this article that you wanted to bring to people's attention that also deserve our attention? You mentioned Pablo Jose Hernandez Rivera, who's Puerto Rico's non-voting representative in the U.S. Once again, just like Washington, we have representation per se in government, but not to the extent as the other states in the U.S., which goes to show you how many parallels there are between Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. when it comes to the undermining of the local government's democratic process. Because let's not forget that Donald Trump right now is also trying to undermine home rule here in Washington as well. But going back to my question, what other components do you think deserve our attention with this story as it continues to develop?
Focus on Puerto Rico, right? As much as you would any other place that's getting attacked by these federal authorities. You know, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and the other colonies often get left out of the news cycle. Like, for example, when was the last time you heard a story about Guam in, like, the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever, right? So give these colonies as much attention as you would any other place in the United States. Know that these places... one, they're all within the 100-mile constitution free zone, the constitution free zone from the CBP, which is how the ACLU described it in 2016 because of how small we are. So in theory, they could stop you at any moment to ask for your documentation. Right. Know your rights, I would say, is a big thing that many immigrant lawyers have repeated to me and many civil rights groups have repeated to me as I've been reporting on this story. And that should be for anyone, whether you're undocumented, whether you have like a green card or you're a U.S. citizen. And help out your neighbors, you know, and help out the groups helping these migrant groups, right? I know in the U.S., Mexico border, there is Al Otro Lado and the Blue Armadillos doing like water drops and food drops in the desert for undocumented migrants trying to get into the United States to claim asylum or anything of that sort, right? These people are just people trying to find a better life for themselves and their families. And the U.S. has made it extremely hard for them to come here, right? I spoke to my grandparents shortly before writing this story about their immigration story, and for them it wasn't easy, but it was significantly easier than it is now, right? I have a very good friend of mine, one of my best friends, is a migrant who got his H-1B visa, or who was hired to get his H-1B visa like a couple days before he had to leave the country because his student visa was running out, right? It's and he was extremely lucky for that. Right. It's very hard to be an immigrant in the United States, and it's going to get harder under this administration. So help each other out because we owe each other everything.
Yeah. And I've also spoken a lot during the course of this conversation about the importance of independent media outlets like WPFW. You cite a lot from El Nuevo Día in Puerto Rico, which is fantastic. You also mentioned this also independent journalism organization in Puerto Rico. Remind me of the name again.
The Center for Investigative Journalism.
Exactly. And they did a fantastic amount of work, especially when the hurricanes hit in Puerto Rico several years ago. And they continue to hit Puerto Rico even now, you know, in anticipation for hurricane season. They have done a fantastic amount of work with regards to discussing the damage and the lack of U.S. support or funding to repair the country, and not to mention the opportunistic capitalism that has taken place in Puerto Rico in the ensuing years. And that just goes to show you why independent media outlets are so important to bring a story like the one that we presented today with Carlos, because otherwise they'll just be forgotten, put by the wayside, and this disaster capitalism that we've seen in places like Puerto Rico will continue unabated so long as independent media outlets continue to dwindle. But it's only possible to expand it if you support independent media outlets like WPFW and the Latino Media Collective, so we can continue to have fantastic guests like Carlos Berrios Polanco on the show. He has done numerous articles, not only to a story like this when it comes to migration, but various other stories that ties to the issue of capitalism and land grabs and government corruption in Puerto Rico. I mean, let's not forget, Carlos, several years ago that there was a lot of protests in Puerto Rico to the institutional corruption by the local government there that also called into question U.S. support for those same corrupt institutions.
For sure.
And it doesn't just go to the government as well, but also to the economic and financial institutions in Puerto Rico, which still remains an ongoing problem so long as there's disaster capitalism implemented, just as institutional as institutional racism in a place like Puerto Rico. So again, to bring all these stories to light, we need your support. We need your financial support from the WPFW audience. So once again, go to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM. And please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. In the meantime, we've been speaking with Carlos Berrios Polanco. He's a freelance writer based in Puerto Rico. His recent article is entitled Puerto Rico's Dominican Community Terrified After Immigration Raids. You can find this on the Latino Newsletter website, and we'll also create a link to his article on our Twitter account. Carlos Berrios Polanco, it's been a long time. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk about this and to hang out. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and you can rest assured that we're going to continue to have conversations like these in the coming 4 years, because again, it's going to be a long 4 years with this current administration. And so with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to encourage everyone once again to support the Latino Media Collective and independent media outlets like WPFW by going to WPFWFM.org to make a donation. And if you have the Cash App on your phone, make a donation to $WPFWFM, and please give credit to the Latino Media Collective when you do so. With that said, that is it for today's show. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao. We'll be right back.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Republican senators pushed a $340 billion budget framework to passage. The early vote today was a key step towards providing money the Trump administration says it needs for mass deportations and security measures. Here's Wyoming Senator John Barrasso.
This budget allocates $175 billion to secure our border. Now, that includes funding for President Trump's successful executive orders to deport criminal illegal immigrants.
Senators chugged through a vote-a-rama considering dozens of amendments before the package was approved on a largely party-line vote of 52 to 48. With little power in the minority to stop the onslaught, Democrats instead used the debate to force GOP senators into potentially embarrassing votes, including blocking tax breaks to billionaires. Here's Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer.
Under Donald Trump's Republican Party, billionaires win and American families lose.
The tax measures will still need to be merged with a bill from the House that includes some $4.5 trillion in tax cuts and up to $2 trillion in less spending. A federal judge is allowing the Trump administration to go ahead with mass firings of federal workers. District Judge Christopher Cooper found five unions suing to block the firings must bring their claims under federal employment law rather than in district court. Since taking office, the Trump administration has overseen the firings of thousands of federal workers. By the narrowest of margins, the Senate voted to confirm Kash Patel as President Trump's FBI director. The near-party line vote puts the Trump loyalist at the head of the nation's premier law enforcement agency, despite Democrats' concerns he'll do Trump's bidding and go after Trump's adversaries. Trump's Justice Department has already forced out a group of senior FBI officials and made a hugely unusual demand for the names of thousands of agents who participated in investigations related to the deadly January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska joined Democratic minority in voting no, citing concerns Patel would focus on settling political scores and purging the FBI. Eileen Alfandari has more.
Senate Judiciary Committee Democrats stood outside the FBI building and warned Republicans against confirming Patel.
My Senate Republican colleagues are willfully ignoring myriad red flags about Mr. Patel, especially his recurring instinct to threaten retribution against his perceived enemies.
Republican Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Charles Grassley denounced what he called vicious Democratic opposition to Patel.
Mr. Patel's career shows that he's a man who will fight to defend the Constitution and fight to expose corruption.
Before he was nominated, Patel said he would come after what he described as anti-Trump conspirators in the federal government and the media. He described convicted January 6 rioters as political prisoners and wrote a children's book that portrayed Donald Trump as a king. I'm Eileen Alfandari.
Israeli forces have dropped leaflets in Gaza threatening Palestinians to leave Gaza or die. This comes after U.S. President Donald Trump has called for the expulsion of Palestinians so the U.S. could develop it into the Riviera of the Middle East. Though many are refusing to leave, even as the delivery of mobile homes has not yet occurred through Israeli checkpoints. Pacifica's Romy Almigari reports from the Gaza Strip.
Ali Alada says he is determined to live in Gaza, his homeland, even if reconstruction of the territory will take decades.
This is never a life. They should make sure to get us the needed resources and supplies.
The Palestinians' post-war struggle is exacerbated by the delayed entry of reconstruction supplies and relief materials into Gaza. These include some 60,000 promised mobile homes as part of a ceasefire deal. Akram Atallah, a Gaza political analyst, suggests preventing mobile homes.